It was decided that any built intervention should employ primary blues and complementary yellows. This was based on the knowledge that not only are these the most visible and luminous colours of the spectrum, but also that any combination of these complementary secondary colours produces white, or maximum brightness. As the image J colour profile in figure 3, which is that... Is that coming through properly? Sorry, as the image J colour profile in figure 3 demonstrates, such an intervention increases overall brightness. This exploitation of the RGB system produced a condition of maximum brightness at the site's prime viewing time. Furthermore, this visual difference was later used to determine programmatic type and distribution. The highly visible yellow zones were assigned the dominant primary programs and the blue zones the secondary less active functions. Unlike conventional physical or virtual translations of picturesque principles, the circular key intervention involves the use of technologies and techniques that contest these authorising processes behind the construction of such images. This disruptive act subtly contaminates the attempt by regulatory authorities to curate images of the city, which are underscored by highly determined and politically sanctioned power structures. This thinking is supported by Louis Maran's study of the narrative and descriptive structures of three different 17th century city portraits in his book Utopics, Spatial Play. In discussing the maps and their associated supplementary images of city life, Maran makes the following three statements. One, the city map represents the reduction of discourse about the city. Two, the deconstruction of this representation uncovers the ideology controlling it. And three, the city map is utopic insofar as it reveals a plurality of places whose incongruity lets us examine the critical space of ideology. Thus, for Maran, the political dynamics of the monarchy serve as an example whereby power functions around both the production of the city portrait and the figurative structures which are illustrated in the interplay between the main city view and its supplementary images. The exercise of political control gained through the right to represent spaces imagistically is therefore inexorably linked to the power structures governing the creation and propagation of the same. Of course, the political import of these maps was profound, despite the prohibitive expense of their manufacture, due to the need to furnish images of the city that cater to the sovereign's expectations. To find a more contemporary democratic example, one must turn to W.J.T. Mitchell's analysis of picturesque landscapes in the essay Imperial Landscapes. The important point here is that democratic power structures necessitate imagistic tactics that appeal to a much broader audience than that of a single select sovereign. Extending this argument, it is safe to say that the accessibility of webcam systems is yet another vehicle by which to democratise the city view. However, caution must be exercised here because accessibility is not the same as possessing agency in the creation of that image. One might well occupy that space, but equally one is not empowered to curate or alter the view. If, as both Maran and Mitchell note, the representational agency of such images is tied to the politics behind their creation, together with the current technologies of production, then the desire to impart figurative meaning to the physical effectively collapses the differentiation between these two aspects, with the result that the image directly mediates and informs the configuration of the real. Like Maran, Mitchell's Imperial Landscapes also reminds us that the decision to frame the landscape from a specific viewpoint, together with its representational techniques and media, inevitably exposes the author's bias. Within this context, the conventions of the representational system can be corrupted to alter the figurative trajectory of the normative, so that to be effective, they must inspire the acquiescence of people to incorporate these images as their own. Sorry. I should actually say at this point that with respect to those two images, the one on the left was generated to show the direct webcam view, as it would, of the of the building as it would be seen by the webcam. And the one image on the right is the image that, or the view of the building that would be seen from the street. So there's a huge discrepancy between these two views. So the image is being seriously mediated by this sort of technology, and therefore offers an opportunity to a designer to intervene within that space. Over the last two decades, the gradual erosion of the symbolic functioning of images and objects in the discipline of architecture has seen the rise of two other paradigms based on either on performance or effect. In the case of the former, architectural form has effectively become understood as a prosthetic device that functions to satisfy specific performative criteria and their privileged data sets. In the latter, form is framed within arguments of the experiential. As such, architecture functioning either as a narrative, narrow performative scientific paradigm, or as an effective object, has effectively fallen back into the two dominant paradigms of modernism, where either form privileges performative functioning over its status as an encultured artefact, or where qualitativity allows the politics of taste to resurface, as in the case of Clement Greenberg. In the essay, A Picturesque Stroll Around Clara Clara, Yves Alain Bois' discussion of Richard Serra's sculptures reminds us that there are two different picturesque traditions, and both relate to figural comprehension. In the first, the beautiful conforms to the more normative understanding of the picturesque, wherein the organisational logic of an object or space becomes revealed and thus knowable. I don't know if you need to see that all the time. In the second, the sublime, any sense of order is refused, and there is no immediate capacity for intelligible formal understanding because the object lacks a discernible gestalt. It remains outside the viewer's capacity to link form with either a figurative trajectory or a knowable experiential quality. The second point is important because the lack of form ensures its figure remains outside predictable phenomenological experience. Important to this discussion is Bois' implicit assumption that the functioning of the sublime is provisional, based upon this figural comprehension rather than upon scale. The significance here is that any object can be aligned to the sublime picturesque. Bois' identification of the issue of figural comprehension is thus doubly significant. In the first case, it allows the object to fall into a semiotic condition. It is asked to stand in for or represent something else. In the second, one's capacity to know is linked to the ability to simply make sense of its form. The beautiful picturesque tradition functions to contain and stabilise the object through establishing a defined viewpoint and frame. This stabilising of the image is crucial because it is the very mechanism by which the author can facilitate a semiotic reading of the object's figure. This point is crucial because it effectively establishes the continuance of a particular type of intellectual tradition that dates back to the 18th century picturesque through to postmodernism, irrespective of whether the object was presented within phenomenological or linguistic tradition. Bois' exposure of the sublime as a condition of figural indeterminacy, rather than as object scale, provides a way in which to better understand the effective potential of the use of optically unstable patterns in this circular key project. The type of sublime effect Bois raises is one where the figure of form is experientially incomprehensible. Thus, the increased luminosity caused by altering the colour rendering of the circular key site requires further tactics to produce a formal instability that stands experientially outside categorisation and also duplication. On one level, this indeterminacy is produced by the use of the Münsterberg pattern as a metric by which to scale the facade. So what was being thought of here was that pattern, as it is part of the image or is incorporated into the image, becomes anamorphically projected onto the facade and therefore can be assembled in specific ways, obviously materially, but to represent program or whatever is actually going on in the building, and certainly in combination with two complementary colours, which would, through the mediation of the webcam, produce a third colour. On another level, the project also exploits the logics underpinning digital pixel systems, The scaling of each facade component to match variations within the camera's depth of field produces a virtual view of the facade that constantly shifts in and out of focus as the camera is manipulated. This blurring is exacerbated by the proposal to construct the facade out of a panelling system where alternating solid black and transparent white sections cause the light to bleed around every joint. So it's always defying stability, this image that you're getting on the screen. These formal manoeuvres produce a variation in density patterning, which when distributed across vertical and horizontal webcam's picture plane, works to create an experiential disjunction between the webcam and the real space of the circular key precinct. The desire to impart spatial depth to the facade further enhances the digital disruption caused by the anamorphic projection of the Munsterberg pattern, ensuring that the experience of real sight is disjunctive from the webcam view. So this image actually is a proposal for another piece of built form which stands further down that precinct. So again, what you're getting here is an exaggeration of the angle or a different response visually to the camera. So the building is actually skewed towards the camera. So the facade reads flat to the camera. Therefore the discrepancy between the real time or the street view on the right is much more heightened according to the exaggeration of the camera angle. So again, the mechanism of the digital system is driving the design or the response to the design. These formal manoeuvres produce a variation in density patterning, which when distributed... Have I read that? Yes, I have. Cumulatively, these design acts subvert the desire of authorities to control and co-opt these city views into a figurative and therefore ideological construct. Unlike the beautiful, which has the potential to fall into the linguistic through referential play, the form here is closer to attaining condition of the sublime, because being beyond comprehension, it is inevitably posited in the realm of indeterminate effect. This notion of effect is fundamentally different from the functioning of the figure in modernist phenomenological aesthetics, because, as a product of the figured object, it can exist without resorting to semiotic abstractions. This avoids the fate of modern and postmodern phenomenology, where the abstract is converted into a new semiotic structure. Consequently, what Bois offers is a conception of phenomenology that allows the abstract to sit outside any conceptual framing, and therefore the politics of taste by incorporating the object's figure. This condition is a very different functioning of the figure from that which Mitchell discusses in Augustus Earle's 1827 painting, A Distant View of the Bay of Islands in New Zealand, which I have a very bad example of here, but that was all I could find, I'm afraid. This condition is a very... Mitchell is careful to point out that Earle subverts picturesque conventions to rupture the normative narrative associated with these types of images and makes particular note of Earle's subversive use of the Maori totem, which disrupts the traditional function of the picturesque side screen lead-in figure. For Mitchell, this contestation is about the conventions of the representation. As he adds, this something else is neither the landscape or nature, but another convention for organising and perceiving the landscape, one that contends with and reshapes the convention that Earle carries as a picturesque traveller. The point Mitchell makes here is that the Maori carved figure is not only a figure that contests the conventions of the European picturesque, but it is also one that demonstrates that the picturesque notion of surveying and viewing the landscape is not distinctly Western. The figure's view may be oriented differently from that of the Western gaze, but it still indicates at a minimum that stopping still just to look at the land is so important to the Maoris that they in fact erect a statue to keep surveillance over a place. The collective disruptive effect of all of these tactics on the webcam's picture plane in the Circular Key project acts in a similar way to that of Earle's carved figure. The point of difference is that these interventions do not lie within the narrative conventions of the image, but instead disrupt the experience of viewing on site, both as a real-time physical and virtual visual experience. The project's agency does not rely on Earle's figurative disruption of meaning and signification, but rather it relies upon the inability of the interventions to stabilise and form imagistically. As with Bois' reading of Serra's sculptures, the figure of this intervention acts as a deceptive formal index that fails to deliver the experience we expect on first sighting. So just to conclude, while the Circular Quay project stops at the facade, there is no doubt that such visual strategies can utilise the scopic regime of CCTV systems to affect interior, real and virtual experience. However, what the project indicates is that the deliberate shifting nature of the image produces an engagement with the view that constantly defies stabilisation and therefore creates a disjunctive moment between image and experience that sits outside comprehension. The operation of the sublime picturesque within this contemporary context means that its function is duplicated by its performance within both virtual and real contexts, and inasmuch it stands outside any quantifiable or stable frame. Consequently, there is neither a moment where the figure can ever be completely understood semiotically or experientially. This tactic not only deliberately challenges the governmental bylaws, but it also challenges the promotional agency of the webcam system itself. This use of the figure and form shifts the issue of representation from portrayal to effect, but it does so in a way that undoes the viewer's capacity to simultaneously read architectural materiality or the figure's form. By disrupting the regulatory control of these images, it also opens a space for productive engagement with the making of city images that refuses either to privilege sanctioned forms or to render stable, unproblematic images of the urban landscape.